And today I'm delighted to be welcoming Peter Fisher on your behalf. Our adult paths have crisscrossed ever since we first met in the college library at Durham in the late 60s. Peter has held steadily to ministry in both parishes and theological colleges. At present, it's a parish in the, I think we could call it, leafy outskirts of Birmingham. Always thinking, always sharing thoughts, thriving on debate, which is why I so much look forward to his opening up for us today the world of René Girard. Let us say together the prayer. God of truth and love, in all ages you have blessed our race with prophetic souls, humble to listen to your truth and bold to share it in love. Make us, we pray, humble in heart to listen to your prophets for our time and brave to act on the truth they bring. Amen. Just before I ask Peter to speak, I'll read the second part of my introduction, which I forgot. His book, Outside Eden, is a gem, compassionate and hugely instructive on the ups and downs of Christian living, with a foreword by Rowan Williams. He's much supported by Elizabeth, his wife, who also teaches theology, but has just retired and enjoying the freedom that that is bringing, not least allowing her to be with Peter today and us. Peter, thank you for bringing your wisdom to share with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. Thank you all. It's such a genuine pleasure to be here. I would like to hope that for most of you, the name of René Girard is relatively unknown. That is my hope. My hope is that among the prophets gathered round this festal table for your series, that he might be the mystery guest. My fear is that there are one or two people here who know him more deeply and better than I do. I was taught by my wife after I'd been lecturing for several years that it really wasn't a good idea to say to every class, I think you know more about this than I do. But in this case, it may not be the truth. A French-American born in 1923 in Avignon, Girard's thought has been breaking new ground for 50 years, up to and well beyond his retirement in 1995, from a professorial chair at Stanford University. His life's project, an exploration of intellectual new worlds, has a brave or even swashbuckling quality about it, which hardly fits the mood or the academic sensitivities of modern life, the kind of specialisms and courtesies. If I just recite The Restless Itinerary, which his writings represent, I think it gives you some idea of his wanderlust and of the fact that he leaves a multitude of specialists complaining of bruised toes because he's trodden all over their fields and their feet. His first studies were in medieval history. Then he rapidly moved on to modern history. From there, he turned to the literary study of novels, and especially the novels of Cervantes, Dostoevsky, and Proust. Then he turned to the study of primitive religions and anthropology, and then to the study of biblical documents and theology. And all the while doing these different things, he keeps on sort of putting his finger in forays into philosophy. An old-fashioned polymathic thinker. And to cap it all, he makes the extraordinary claim in his mature work that the key to understanding how and who we are, how our cultures and societies came to be, and how we can find an authentic way of life in society, is in the Christian gospel, and there alone. If you think about this wide-ranging and strongly focused thinker, you'll understand why many people see him as an old-fashioned intellectual and religious imperialist, the kind of person who has a grand idea and brings it to bear on every sphere of thought. But I beg you not to be put off by that thought. Girard himself, who comes across to me, I've never met him, as a brave but surprisingly humble man, would prefer to compare himself with Darwin. That's not exactly modesty, I know. But with Darwin in this way. Yes, the potential scope and significance of the insights is universal, immensely wide-ranging, and could change our views of lots of things. But the observations and the insights on which those possible world-changing views rest are themselves fairly delicate and precise. So you're not talking about a grand theory which derives from nowhere so much as an interpretation of certain key things in the history of literature and of anthropology and of faith. It's to those quite specific, tightly focused observations and interpretations I want to turn. And if you did see the... if you've got the handout, it's at this point that if you like diagrams, please use the diagram. If you find that less than helpful, it doesn't matter. I've tried to represent a simple abstract of Girard's thought in this diagram, which shows three squares. They're meant to be overlapping circles, but they've come out as squares because of the mysteries of the computer or my ineptitude. And they've gone square in the process of printing. They actually meant to overlap a little bit, but you can see that they're juxtaposed with one circle. And we're going to start at the left at the bottom. Mimesis and identity, rivalry and crisis. Mimesis, Greek word for imitation. Why not just say imitation? Well, because most of us, when we use the word imitation, are thinking of a conscious, a deliberate act. We're thinking of, I look at somebody and I think, oh, that's good, I'll try it myself. We're not thinking of something deep-seated, as it were, within the mechanisms which make us who we are, whereby, for instance, we pick up language. You know, we don't sort of think, oh, mum's saying something interesting there, I'll try to say it. So mimesis stands for a structured and profound tendency within us. Now, just suppose that my human identity and yours, and particularly my desires, which Girard would say are absolutely central to the forming of identity, our desires are not formed on the basis of... Oh, you printed on both sides of the paper. Yes, pardon me. A little slip on my part. Not the products of some innate instincts, you know, not grounded in some things inside me, but my desires, and therefore my identity, arises in the context of a mimesis, arises in the context of a recognizing what you desire and wanting it. How do I know what to want? I know what to want because I see what others want, especially certain very significant others. And when I see what they want, I want it too. So desire is born in interrelationship. But desire is, from the first instant, triangular. It's me and you wanting that. And it's not a very far step from that to realizing that if that is the nature of the very birth of desire, then desire is born in potential conflict. Desire of itself is necessarily competitive, or to use the word that Girard favours, rivalrous. Desiring is always the desiring of what you've already seen somebody desire. You learn it, you want it yourself, you acquire the same desire, you find yourself in a potentially, not always a conflictual relationship. You know, parenthood is all about managing the potential conflict in that, but nonetheless, there's the potency, the possibility for conflict there all the time. This means that since societies are the agglomeration of these desires and identities, primitive societies, Girard thinks, will always be under threat of crisis. The crisis which occurs when the tension within mimesis becomes contagious. Because what we see when we're looking at people and our desires is at a certain point, it's not just a case that a lot of people want something, but that the very desiring becomes contagious, a mood of let me have, which takes over a whole group. As an analogy, I think of a rugby match with two inebriated teams. It may be an unfair analogy. I mean, I'm sure those of you who played rugby don't think there are ever inebriated rugby teams. But two drunken rugby teams come to a confrontation. The object of desire, the ball, disappears from view. It doesn't matter where the ball is any longer. The contagion of rivalry has taken over. And the confrontation, perhaps, of two individuals rapidly becomes a collective punch-up. That's just a little picture of how Girard thinks primitive societies are always on the brink of breakdown through internal violence. But that is not the whole story. And at this point, we're moving across from mimesis and identity, rivalry and crisis, to the square on the right. This story of potential crisis is not the whole story. For Girard detects the shape of an ancient resolution or cure. And this is a real key to the unusual nature of his thought. He sees in ancient texts and the survivals of ancient rituals, half hidden, a certain characteristic pattern. It's a pattern which we might well, short in a single word, call scapegoating. He thinks of it as possibly arising in the first instance as a kind of chance discovery. If we take our prehistoric rugby match, what happens? It so happens that as the brawl is coming to a height, an elderly spectator comes rushing onto the pitch and tries to intervene to stop the fight. Well, an unspoken mutual consent occurs between the two teams, and they turn their attentions from fighting one another to all of them getting rid of the old man. And the old man is, as you might say, booted into touch. And a strange peace descends on the teams. Again, it's only an analogy, but it's an analogy for the process which Girard thinks is absolutely central to the formation of ancient societies, which is to say that it's discovered that you can resolve internal violences which themselves are fatal, because those internal violences become kinship battles, tribal battles, destructive of the whole structure and fabric of a society. And in place of them, you find you can actually visit the tension, the rivalry, on a single victim. Dispose of the victim, and the victim becomes a kind of victim hero, a strange figure who's kind of outside and both below and above the society, the person whose sacrifice has made peace. The community, having these chance experiences, like the rugby match, wants, you might say, to bottle this. You know, crisis occurs again. What do? You recollect that a way of resolving this without damaging, as it were, the integrity of the society is by victimization. So it is bottled in myths and bottled in religion. Girard believes the origins of religion lie within that process, the process of sacrifice. Sacrifice viewed as the way in which the tensions within society are resolved by expulsion. Here then, through myth and ritual, the cure can be kept and regularly administered. And of course it gradually parts company with individual crises. You do it as a regular activity which sustains the society in peace through all its troubles. Here then is a thread of understanding which links the way our desires are formed, the roots of violence in society, and the foundational significance of sacrifice for religion and culture. Having detected this chain, Girard sees the evidence everywhere to hand. And actually, it's quite interesting. You know, once you start following him and you think about different stories, you think, well, I hadn't looked at that story in that light. He sees it in the Oedipus myth and in so many different myths. He sees it in the founding murder myths of Rome and of Babylon, in the sacrificial ordinances of the ancient Chinese Book of Rites, in the plays of Euripides, in the Levitical laws for the Day of Atonement, and, of course, in all the Jew hunts of Europe, up to and including the Holocaust. Now we're ready to move on, or nearly ready, to move on to the third and final circle. But before we do that, we have to note something important about the whole scapegoating cycle. You get the basic picture. We are built in such a way as to find our nature through rivalry, through imitation and rivalry. The rivalry will explode, but there is a way in which we can resolve it and restore order and peace. That's the way of scapegoating. But the trouble about scapegoating is that it doesn't work once it's been detected. You've not got to think that what you're doing is scapegoating. The word scapegoating is a modern reading of an ancient rite, if you like. And as long as we don't think of the one being victimized as being victimized, we can still believe in the process. It's very important to Girard that ancient societies, and indeed many modern ones too, don't actually realize what they're doing in this process, which brings a kind of peace. He tells the story of drawn from the life of Apollonius of Tyana by Philostratus, a Greek writer of the Hellenistic period. Apollonius is a great healer. The people of Ephesus are suffering from a plague, and nothing will cure the plague. So they beseech Apollonius to come and help them. He arrives rather miraculously and then gathers all the people of Ephesus into the arena. The whole city, apparently. In the arena, there comes an aged beggar. A beggar with an old scrip with a bit of bread in it. He seems almost blind and blinking. Apollonius calls on the people of Ephesus to stone him. At first, they're very unwilling. They say, why should we stone a poor mendicant? But he eggs them on, and such is his charisma and power, that they begin to pick up stones, begin to cast them, and then they see that the blind beggar's eyes open. He looks at them, and there is fire in his eyes, as of a demon. They carry on stoning him, and when the pile of stones risen high above his body, Apollonius instructs them to take the stones away. They take the stones away, and underneath they see not the body of a human, but the body of a massive hound, the size of a great lion, an evil monster. Well, the point of retelling that little story here is that as long as they thought he was a beggar, they couldn't really get away with the act of victimization. He had to be demonized in the process. And once he was demonized, this, of course, cured the plague. And you may think of equivalents in English history where events have occurred where, for instance, Jews in medieval England have been blamed for the causing of a plague. And it's only by dint of demonizing the people responsible that the mechanism works. Human sacrifice, like that, only works if we don't realize what's going on. We don't realize that the choice of a victim is arbitrary. That means there's a big difference between our age and all previous ages, according to Girard. Not that victimizing no longer happens, but that the process is spotted. We live in the era when people understand victimization. Not just that, when it's become a key, a universal key, to a kind of moral world, that that's the one thing really not to be permitted. Somehow, in the course of history, the veil has been lifted on this deep-rooted and powerful process whereby social violence is siphoned off and peace maintained. Of course, this doesn't mean that victimization has disappeared. Sometimes victimization now takes this double form, which we observe quite frequently, where somebody is accused of victimizing in order to make them a victim. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if we think about the recent example of the letter of condolence written by Gordon Brown. It's a very subtle and difficult question. Who's victimising whom? Is that right? And by definition, somebody like a prime minister is a good target for victimisation, because you'll appreciate that the process rests on finding somebody. It may be a random choice, but it's not entirely random, because the choice of victim must be somebody who is not going to tear apart our kinship structures. Prime minister's outside them. Prime minister's the boss. You can victimise the boss, because the rest of us will still be okay, just as you can victimise the beggar. So victimisation continues, but in ever increasingly complex and less effective ways. We don't get satisfaction from it. It doesn't resolve our crises. It becomes an intricate web of accusation and counter-accusation. To that extent, sacrifice no longer works. Nobody believes in it. Girard himself seems to have recognised this lifting of the veil for the first time in these novels, particularly Dostoevsky. And from those novels, he proceeds to understand the whole process, not just of scapegoating, but of its revelation. I think we might just have a moment to think about Dostoevsky, and you may well know his novels, but particularly in The Brothers Karamazov, there's a very clear representation of this kind of mimetic rivalry. Dostoevsky does this. He shows how people are activated by wanting what the other has, and by resentment at the way somebody else has taken what they wanted, and the way that this goes deep into human characters. But then Dostoevsky also explores in an extraordinary way how that is overcome without violence in these particular characters who enter the drama without power and yet prove to be able to show all that's wrong with the evil in their society. So in the famous parable of the Grand Inquisitor in The Brothers Karamazov, the figure of Christ concludes what looks like a very ambivalent argument, not with his own view or any assertion of what he's there for, but by kissing the Grand Inquisitor. One writer has put it like this about Girard, that Dostoevsky inspired him not just to allow his Christian faith into his research, but to dare to see the Christian revelation, the Gospels, as its very foundation. See, up to now, I haven't said anything about Christianity at all, as far as I'm aware. All I've said about religion has been to do with a process whereby sacrificial victims somehow restore peace. We could call that bad religion. We would have to reflect on how much bad religion there is still around, which obtains its power by its ability to exclude and make safe those who are not excluded. But now we come to the insight which came to Girard about 1959-60 from reading Dostoevsky and others, that the gospel itself is the answer to this. The gospel holds the clue to this. He became a Christian not long before he published the two novel studies in 1961 and 63. A two-part conversion, first of the mind, then of the heart and soul. The intellectual conversion was the consequence of coming to see the Gospels in a new light. In order to see that, I must spend one moment speaking about the Old Testament. The Old Testament points the way to a new understanding of the reality of God and of good religion. Oedipus is the classic myth on the one hand, and in it, Oedipus has violated the rules of the gods. His expulsion is right. Joseph is the typical figure of the Genesis patriarchal narrative. He's also an expelled figure, expelled by the brothers, cast into the pit, left to die. The narrative tells it from Joseph's point of view. The myths, which represent, if you like, bad religion, Israel's understanding, tell it from society's point of view, validating the exclusion. The scriptures tell it from Joseph's point of view, validating the victim. So you can go through. You can talk about the cursing psalms. He gets very steamed up about Christians and the way that we won't use the cursing psalms, very superior about them. Can't say all these nasty words about get rid of my enemies. He says, yes, but here, for the first time in any ancient literature, of words which are spoken by the victim. When we read the cursing psalms, we are seeing life from the bottom up, from the point of view of those who've been cast out. So the scriptures, especially in the servant songs, where they show the suffering servant as being actually the agent of God, are the key to a new way of looking at life, in which you no longer gain peace by excluding the victim. And that new insight, that new revelation, then comes to its height in the Gospels. The figure of the crucified. Here, God is openly seen occupying the place of the victim. The whole story, from betrayal to crucifixion and resurrection, is a telltale. It's a story that reveals what's going on all the time, which shows up the mechanisms of social order attained through the cycle of violence, unjust expulsion, and sacrifice. And when in Luke's Gospel, Jesus says from the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," he's not making a kind of liberal wishy-washy, poor things, they're a bit silly. He's saying, they are caught up in a process they can never understand. Like the rest of humanity, they only know the way to overcome their rivalry by destroying the other. And I'm the other they're destroying. And only because that story can be told by a few faithful disciples in the power of the Holy Spirit is the lid lifted on the way in which social order is maintained by this process of sacrificial victimage. They know not what they do. Well, that in a nutshell is the 15-minute version of the plays of Shakespeare with no costumes. And I'm sorry it has to be such a rush through, but it has to be. And it has to be, I think, not just because of my compressing the data, but because Girard's thought is a string. Where, if it makes sense at all, and if it's prophetic at all, it's prophetic because it links certain key insights, the ones I've tried to be explaining to you, and then goes on to say that the gospel is a way in which those insights are actually given us by God to use. Girard dares to reject the 19th century masters of suspicion, Freud's account of human motivation, Marx's account of social order, and he rejects the postmodern flight from explanation. Man cannot live, he writes, on bread and sexuality. We need meaning, and it's meaning he tries to offer, offering at the same time a multitude of hostages to fortune. Now his outlook is not cheery. The Christian revelation, he writes, clarifies not only everything that goes before it, the religion and culture of myth and ritual, but also everything that comes after it, the history we're in the process of making, the ever-growing disintegration of archaic religion, the opening into a future joining of all mankind into one world. It is more and more liberated from ancient forms of servitude, that's our world. But by the same token, it is deprived of all sacrificial protection. It's no longer a safe world. The old way secured a certain social harmony, and everywhere we look, we see the inability any longer to do that. We are, he believes, living in an apocalyptic age. His latest book links the work of the military theorist Clausewitz with the message of the apocalyptic passages in the New Testament. There is no easy way, he says, that a God of nonviolence, whose way of triumphing over Satan was to die on the cross and so reveal the satanic ways in which we oppress one another, there is no way for that God to stop the processes by which, once bad religion has been lost, confusion and chaos begin to reign. There is only the promise that that crucified God, who is victim himself, is the bringer of peace. I always cherished the hope, he writes recently, that meaning and life were one. Me too.
Thank you, Peter, very much indeed. You've given us deep things to think about, and I hope that people will go away and find out more about Girard. If you're like me, you will Google René Girard. I don't often Google, but I did this time, and find a wonderful essay called Are the Gospels Mythical?, which is just so stunningly fresh and as if only he had ever thought of it before, but it seems so true. Thank you for opening up to us a complex, awkward, difficult, but ultimately true prophet of our time.